Hello, Stephen. How was your long weekend?
It was not too bad. Good to hear your voice. It's been a while. Our schedules have not coincided.
They have not. No, we are like what do they say? Ships in the night, or is that just for married couples? I don't want to presume anything. I don't want people getting the wrong idea.
Don't go too far. Yeah,
that's right. No, it has been a while. It was of all the weeks to take off, last week wasn't the week to do it. Between everything going on in the NHL, Blue Jays getting things going, it was a storm of activity, and it's going to be awfully quiet now. But I want to ask you about the Blue Jays. It felt like a lot. I know that's the number one reaction. I know Jeff Blair, one of your partners there, he's like, you know, you got to pay to get. You got to get off the fence sometimes. Two very good prospects for the Jays to bring in, Berrios. I'm curious your thoughts. Worth it or risky?
Well, it's both, I think. I think it can be both. And I think, you know, Blair's right, that, you know, you have to give to get, especially in what was the seller's market for starting pitching, you know, because it was really Scherzer and Berrios who are the two, the top two starters available, and everybody needs pitching. So you're not going to get them for, you know, one of those fantasy deals where, you know, fans come up with, where you give away the worst guy in your roster and a couple of guys you know are no good, and then suddenly you get a starter with control. It doesn't work that way. So they had to beat out some other teams to get them. And I'm sure they didn't part with those guys easily. One guy they fell to them at, you know, five in the draft, and some people, you know, Austin Martin, people thought he was potentially the best guy in that draft. So, you know, and obviously Simeon Woods Richardson came over in the Stroman deal as the best part of that deal, in theory. He's had kind of a rough season this year, but, you know, he's playing with Team USA in the Olympics. So, yeah, you gave up guys who both may turn out to be very good major league players to get a season and 2 months of a starting pitcher who has been as consistent and durable as just about anybody in baseball, and really good. So, but I think it's an interesting move. I guess the main thing is that if you're going to deal prospects, you know, one reason you accumulate prospects and build a farm system and get all those, you know, kudos from Fangraphs and all those places that rate prospects is to deal them. They're not all going to play for you, and they're not all going to make it. And, you know, they're not, some of them are going to get blocked by other prospects or other young major league players. So the trick is to know your guys better than other people know them, and to deal guys who, you know, probably for one reason or another are not going to be, you know, within a time, at least not make your major league roster within a time frame, you know, that you, a window for contention. And maybe you know that they're a little bit more flawed in certain ways than other people know. Like, it's not like you're playing people for suckers, because everybody, you know, people have seen, everybody scouted the heck out of Austin Martin, you know, and everybody scouted the heck out of Simeon Woods Richardson. So they've seen them. But you should know more about them than other teams do. And, you know, especially given that there was no minor league season last year, so that was all kind of weird. The stuff happened kind of behind closed doors, and limited minor league season this year. You should be able to evaluate your people better than other people can evaluate your people. Sometimes, you know, sometimes you get it wrong. But, you know, if you go back to 2015, the famous example, and again, there are other examples that are the absolutely opposite. But if you look at everything Alex Anthopoulos gave up that year for Tulowitzki and David Price, you know, the best guy out of all of that was Matthew Boyd, who is, you know, a solid but unspectacular major league starter. Like, the more highly touted guys didn't pan out. So, you know, maybe that's dumb luck, or maybe they knew something.
And the other part of it is, too, I think it would be one thing if they hadn't graduated any young players to the major league roster. Then it's harder to give up on some of those young guys, I would think. But this team is full of young guys that have been homegrown or that are at the very beginning of their major league career. I think that you're right. Not only do you have to give up to get, you also have to find room for these guys. And you find room for great players, but Berrios, kind of a sure thing. He's going to play for you, and it's always a question mark. Until guys do, you just don't know.
Yeah, it's you know, how much time do we spend talking about Nate Pearson? You know, number one pitching prospect in all of baseball, who for a variety of reasons still isn't there. And, you know, Alec Manoah leapfrogged him. just, you know, a guy who was a high draft pick and all of that, but didn't have quite the prospect shine. And Alek Manoah is now in a, you know, a big league starter and a dominant big league starter, and Nate Pearson's still trying to figure it out. So it's not, that's the other thing. It's not always, you know, it's, well, it's almost never a straight line. Like, the development curve is not what you think it is. That's why it's, you know, baseball so different than other sports, like very much different than hockey or football or basketball even, because, you know, you draft a guy really high in either of those sport, any of those sports, they play, right? They're, you know, maybe a hockey player goes back to junior for a year, but you expect them within the first couple of years to be part of your lineup and an impact guy. Whereas in baseball, you know, they sign guys who are 16, you know, from in the international signings, they draft guys out of high school, and you're, it's a 5-year process a lot of the time before they get to the majors. And a lot of stuff can happen, and it's hard to project sometimes, you know, exactly what's going to happen. So it's, yeah, it's a bit of a crapshoot. Some, you know, prospects are always a bit of a crapshoot. They're not sure things. We talk about them way more now than people used to back in the day. We, you know, and people talk about them like they know them, like they've actually seen them play. Like, no one's seen Austin Martin play unless, you know, unless you were in that, you know, you were buying tickets in to watch double A ball. You know, so we listen to the Keith Laws and all those guys who spend their lives doing it. But there's more of a, you know, obsession's probably too strong, but, you know, way more of a focus on kind of prospect porn, you know, than there used to be. And, I think sometimes that it kind of throws things out of kilter in terms of, you know, where guys really are, how close they are to the big leagues, and whether, you know, how much of a coin flip it is if that they'll pan out.
And I know that this deal isn't that, it isn't what I'm about to explain. Like it isn't that. But whenever you can show your clubhouse or show your team that you have faith in them, because you go back a number of years, Maddie and I were talking about it this morning when Jose Bautista came out after the trade deadline had come and gone and nothing was done. He's like, geez, it would have been nice to have gotten some help. We're playing pretty well. Could have used some help in here. And then that kind of soured the water a little bit. And guys, when you don't do something, it can be, you paint it and position it as, we've got confidence in this group. There's nothing we can do to help this group, but it's often taken as, they don't think we've got it. And I know that it's not this, but for a young team like that, for all that they've gone through, three different home ballparks now this season, to get a jolt in the arm is probably not a bad thing for them. It's almost like a kind of a nice reward in a way as well.
Yeah. No, look, I think it is part of it. Like, it's not the biggest part of it, because you still have to be kind of cold-blooded and unemotional about this stuff. You have to be analytical about it. But, yeah, I remember 2014 was that horrible trade deadline in Toronto. And so that's, you know, a year before the crazy trade deadline in 2015. But, you know, they'd made the Marlins deal, and they'd kind of shaken up that roster, and it was an old team, you know, an older team, and it was on a timeline. And they were handicapped, you know, they were hamstrung because they didn't have payroll. Like Alex Anthopoulos, now you can say that's ownership's fault for not giving him more payroll, or it was Alex Anthopoulos' fault for not taking into account the deadline and not having any wiggle room left. You know, blame who you choose to blame. But they couldn't make a move for money reasons. And the guys in the clubhouse, you know, that team, you know, had huge expectations coming off the Marlins deal, and that didn't really pan out. And, you know, Bautista was a superstar by then, and Encarnacion. And those guys were kind of saying, look, you know, throw us a crumb here, right? Give us a chance. And that did sour that clubhouse. Now, that was kind of a sour clubhouse anyway, I got to say, in some corners. There were some folks in there who were naturally pretty sour.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is the opposite here. You've got a young team with a core group that you think is going to be around for a long time, that, you know, is kind of ahead of schedule. You're 2 years off being a 95 loss team. They're super confident, and they're kind of a happy bunch, it would appear. Like, again, I haven't seen them up close yet because of, you know, that pandemic thing. But, you know, everybody will tell you that they're a pretty happy group of guys, and they're very confident. Springer has been a really nice add to that group. And it probably does mean something emotionally to give them a bit of a gift here after, yeah, Dunedin and Buffalo and, you know, all of the playing in a bubble and all of the stuff that they've been through in the last year and a half. Yeah, I think that's not inconsequential. It's just not reason one, but it's on the list.
And we've talked over the years that for the Blue Jays or for any team in the AL East, you try and find that little pocket where maybe the Yankees are on a down year and the Red Sox are on a down year. Well, this is not one of those years. I mean, the Yankees are struggling, and I'm not sure what it's going to end up being. But, I mean, the Rays are good as always. Red Sox are having a good year. Still, say what you will, Yankees. This is not one of those things where they tried to strike while the rest of the division was rebuilding.
No, it's a combination of stuff. Like, again, it's partially about next year, you know, and again, not like they're punting on this year, because if you look at that wild card race and look at where they are in the loss column, which is, you know, kind of the place you should start, they're competitive. And, you know, there's teams, like, I'm still not sure Boston, I still keep waiting for Boston to collapse. It hasn't happened. And they are going to get Chris Sale back, which might mitigate against that. You know, I'm not sure how good Oakland really is. You know, the Yankees, I'm not sure who's going to pitch for them. But it's not like those teams are cratering this year. It's going to be super competitive in the AL East. But, you know, you also can look ahead to next year and say, okay, in our rotation next year, we can say we've got Ryu, we've got Manoa, we've got Barrios. That's a pretty good start. You know, that's three pretty good pieces. We've got Ross Stripling, who's, you know, has been a useful guy. They might not be able to re-sign Robbie Ray. They might not want to re-sign Steven Matz. But they can go out into the marketplace. And again, there's Nate Pearson kind of knocking on the door, and maybe he finally kind of gets healthy and straightens it out. But it's about this year having a shot, taking a shot, but it's not an all or nothing, because, you know, 2022 is a big year in terms of, you know, where this organization is headed. And, you know, they have been aggressive in the free agent market the last 2 years. I would expect them to be aggressive in the free agent market again. And they also, again, there's more chances to wheel prospects for the present. So that's the fact he's not just a straight up rental. That's enormously significant.
Turns out George Springer can play, right? For a good chunk of this year, maybe don't even need him. But no, he seems to be like a guy that knows what he's doing out there, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's good. You know, he's good for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when he was hurt, and, you know, I guess I know it's frustrating when a guy gets hurt and you kind of, you know, it's not like his arm fell off or something, so it's not obvious. You know, he's not in a cast, so it's not obvious what's wrong with him. But, you know, all of that kind of the griping about him being missing the time he did, I think you're seeing a ball player who, well, there's a reason, again, a reason why he was kind of top of the class in terms of free agents last offseason. And he's a really, you know, he's not the greatest defensive center fielder in baseball at this stage, but he's really good. And, you know, offensively, he can do a lot of stuff. He's, you know, he's a really, really good baseball player. So, there's been some disappointments this year. Like, I think you look at that line of music, you know, Kevin Biggio's taken several steps back, and I think there's questions now about what he is. I think Lourdes Gurriel looks like a guy that, you know, maybe they should have dealt him in that very attractive contract he has to somebody who imagines him as a, you know, an impactful offensive player. He might be still, but, you know, unfulfilled potential right now. But, like, George Springer is as much of a guarantee. You know, if you look at his track record, he's pretty much guaranteed. You know, they gave him that money for a reason. And that's even with some kind of glitches in that lineup, boy. They're going to be interesting. You know, they get Corey Dickerson back this week.
That's right.
Like,
yeah.
You know, as a left-handed bat. You know, there's not a lot of easy outs in that lineup. There are a lot of things they can do offensively. And, you know, they don't have to have everybody in that lineup at absolute peak in order to be threatening. Now, you know, you watch yesterday's game, you say, well, what happened yesterday? You know, how come they only scored a couple of runs against a lousy Cleveland pitching staff? Then, you know, it happens. But, yeah, there's a lot of ways that this team could beat you right now.
Stephen Braun is our guest. One of the things you had on your list here was talk Olympics, especially women's soccer. And I'll tell you what, there's something about the women, this matchup, the true dislike for each other. You see it the odd time in men's sports, but you think back to, like, Hayley Wickenheiser, Cammy Granato, those two, that vintage of the women's hockey. And now this, the Christine Sinclair, Megan Rapinoe, like this, they hate each other. And it brought out the best. I mean, it's great when you win, you hate to lose. But man, how great was this going back to the weekend?
It was fantastic. And you know what? This is a strange tournament because Canada's going to play for a gold medal, and they may win a gold medal. They got to beat a really good Sweden team to get a gold medal, but they're going to get at least a silver in a tournament where I don't think they've been great. You know, but sometimes that in it's different than a World Cup. You know, the shorter format, you can kind of, you know, if you kind of scrape through a couple of times, suddenly you're playing, you know, you're in a gold medal game. And, you know, they were the Brazil game, the going to penalties, Christian Sinclair missing the first penalty and say, that's over. It's done. You know, they weren't great in the opening game against Japan. They've kind of scuffled. And, you know, they had one shot on goal against the Americans in that match, and it was the penalty. That's it. But, you know, they were really disciplined. They were really organized. This American team's not as good as, you know, it's not playing as well as some previous American teams. But, yeah, that's – I remember talking – Christine Sinclair, by the way, is the of all the athletes I've covered in my professional life, she is my favorite. It's not even close, you know. And she's a really private person. She's really shy. She's a challenging person to interview and to get to know. But, you know, the kind of the resilience and the kind of steeliness that comes through in her, I adore. I think she's really special. And, you know, she's playing on kind of fumes in this tournament. She's 37. She can't run the way she used to. But I'll tell you, my favorite moment so far in the Olympics, and there's been a pretty good ones, was when she handed the ball to Jessie Fleming on that penalty.
Yeah.
And said, I'm not taking it, because it's hers to take, right? She's the captain. And whether she did that because she wasn't feeling super confident after missing that penalty against Brazil, or because she did that because she thought, boy, Jessie Fleming's playing out of her mind right now. But that decision, boy, you know, you talk about kind of all the intangible stuff that goes into sports and team sports and winning and culture and all of the, you know, buzzwords and cliches. That's it. That's to do that on that stage. You know, it takes as much guts to hand that ball off as it does to take the shot. Honest to God.
Sure.
It really does. Because if Jessie Fleming misses that penalty and the Americans win, everybody in the world is going to be saying, how come you chickened out? You know, how come you didn't take it?
Mm-hmm.
But she made the right decision for her team. And of course, look, they got jobbed in 2012. We all know that. You know, that horrible refereeing decision in against the Americans. And the Americans have, like, attitude. I remember talking to Sinclair about when she set the goal-scoring record for women's football, women's soccer, and she beat out Abby Wambach, the American, great American player. But, you know, there's a swagger and arrogance about the Americans, well-earned because they were the best in the world, and they've mostly been the best in the world for the last God knows how long. But the satisfaction – I remember asking her, I said, it's better. You know, the fact that you're going to – you know, move past Abby Wambach. If it was just somebody else, if it was Marta or somebody, it wouldn't feel the same. And I finally got her to admit it, you know, that, yeah, it was great. So that's why all of that stuff was built into that, you know, and Sink is the last one left from the team that collapsed back in the World Cup in 2011 in Germany, kind of completely fell apart and then was rebuilt from the ground up. She's the last one, you know, from that London team. And, I you try to be dispassionate as a reporter, but I am not dispassionate when it comes to those women. I was as thrilled as anybody when they won that match. And, you know, we'll see what happens in the gold medal game. They might not win, but that's, you know, I'm not saying it doesn't matter because they won that one, but
it kind of
doesn't matter because of who they beat.
Yeah. And you wonder there too, does that's what you fight now? You hear about that all the time in sports, and certainly at the Olympics where you face a rival and then you beat them and then you got to get back up again to play another one, where it just, even though the stakes are higher, it doesn't feel like it has the same magnitude as the one you just played.
Yeah, emotionally it'll be tricky, I think. But I think they might play a little freer against Sweden because they have seemed a bit, you know, a bit constricted in some of these matches. They have kind of scraped by, and they've been, you know, they've played a very conservative kind of game. So, I'm wondering if that kind of takes, you know, it's not like it's the job's over, but I wonder if that liberates them a little bit. And, we'll see. I would say they're not favorites going into this match against Sweden, but, sometimes I say the dynamic within a tournament sometimes is different than, you know, all the rating systems and the handicapping and all that stuff. Teams just kind of, especially in soccer, teams just seem to be able to find themselves and get better over the course of a tournament and win. It happens all the time in the World Cup or the Euros, you know, any of those big kind of international tournaments. And that kind of feels like that's what's happening here, that, you know, you scrape by, and but you get better, you know, along the way.
So what is on the Stephen Brunt radar here for the week?
Well, I am still in the in the Western Newfoundland here, obviously. The rain has stopped. It's been a bit rainy out here. But I'm back working this week. I'm back doing radio this week and my other gigs. So I'm going to try and focus on that and not on the things I could be doing while not doing radio. If you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know. Trust me. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's tough there, though, when it's right out your back door. It's like, well, I could just be.
Yeah. I'm looking at it right now out the window. Right now. It's not that easy, but you know, it's a small price to pay for being out here all summer.
Attaboy, Steve. Thanks, buddy. We'll talk to you Friday, all right?
All right. See you, boo.